From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. David Gurevich wasn't exactly a Soviet dissident. He never signed a petition, never was in jail. But he rebelled with rock and roll, blue jeans, and movies. On today's Fresh Air, one Soviet émigré's story of coming of age in the 60s, Soviet style. Also, journalist Frank Smythe continues his story about being captured by Iraqi soldiers while reporting on the Kurdish uprising. He was held prisoner for 17 days. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Backdraft. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Rebels in the Ethiopian province of Eritrea claim today that they've captured the provincial capital, Asmara, after government troops there surrendered. If the rebel claim is confirmed, it would mean that the Eritrean People's Liberation Front now controls most of the province. A second rebel group now claims to be within 20 miles of Addis Ababa and to be close to having the capital surrounded. Both groups have rejected calls for a ceasefire from the country's acting leadership, which took power after President Mengistu Haile Mariam resigned and fled. As the rebels close in, the Ethiopian government is allowing Israel to airlift thousands of Ethiopian Jews from Addis Ababa. Israel had been negotiating with the Mengistu government for years to obtain permission for the Jews to emigrate, but when the opportunity finally came, people had to leave with no advance notice at all. Joyce Miller reports from Addis Ababa.
At 6 in the morning, a committee of Ethiopian Jews who work with the embassy were sent out to the field and told to collect neighborhood by neighborhood and bring them into the embassy. They were told to bring absolutely nothing with them because of security reasons and also because of lack of space on the airline. So the people basically came in their clothes, and a lot of people tried to sneak in bags of clothes, and what ended up is they were told to just put on a couple of layers of clothes. So men were walking on with 2-3 layers of pants on. Some women were wearing double dresses. Anything to just hold on to a few meager possessions.
Joyce Miller reporting from the Ethiopian capital. A delegation of officials from the Palestine Liberation Organization is expected in Damascus tomorrow. The meeting marks the first time that Syria has invited the PLO for talks since the end of the Gulf War. NPR's Deborah Amos reports.
For the Palestine Liberation Organization, the invitation to Damascus is an important sign that its post-war isolation from powerful Arab governments may be ending. The PLO leader, Yasser Arafat, publicly supported Iraq's Saddam Hussein after the invasion of Kuwait, putting him at odds with his financial backers in the Gulf and other Arab political patrons. In the aftermath of the war, Syria promoted an alternative leadership for the PLO. But in the past weeks, a new relationship with the old leadership has developed. Recently, Syria released several hundred Palestinian prisoners held in Syrian jails, and the country's foreign minister met with PLO representatives in Cairo. There's been no public agenda for the talks, but there's lots to talk about. The moves by the U.S. for a Middle East peace process and the PLO's presence in neighboring Lebanon. In Damascus, this is Deborah Amos.
The stock market moved upward today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained almost 14 points to close at 2,913.9. Advances led declines by nearly 2-1 in light trading of 124 million shares. This is NPR News. The South African government freed 8 hunger-striking political prisoners today. The men were among about 200 prisoners who began the hunger strike 24 days ago, when the government refused to free them in time for an April 30th deadline demanded by the African National Congress. The government and the ANC have been disputing over who can be defined as a political prisoner. South Africa's justice minister said the prisoners freed today were released on high-level medical advice. In Durban, a third hunger striker was admitted to a hospital today. With the Senate vote extending fast-track negotiating powers to President Bush, formal negotiations for a free trade pact between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada are expected to begin soon. In Mexico City, Sandina Robbins reports on Mexican government reaction.
Official reaction to the fast-track vote has been surprisingly low-key. While the Mexican government went all out lobbying U.S. legislators, now the official position is much more cautious. President Salinas was phoned by President Bush shortly after the Senate vote, and the two leaders agreed to begin formal negotiations as soon as possible. But heavy criticisms of a closed process forced Salinas to promise that the negotiations would be open to public debate. Opposition parties on the right and left demand that the Salinas administration be held accountable. Democratic Revolution Party leader Cuauhtemoc Cárdenas expressed concern that Mexico will be swallowed up by its more powerful northern neighbors. But he said there's still time to influence the contents. For National Public Radio, I'm Sandina Robbins in Mexico City.
Some 250,000 mourners gathered in New Delhi today for the funeral of former Indian Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi. Gandhi was assassinated on Tuesday in an apparent suicide bombing during an election rally in southern India. So far, heavy security seems to have prevented the rioting that many officials feared would follow Gandhi's murder. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. American baby boomers can reminisce endlessly about coming of age in the 60s. My guest David Gurevich has a different story to tell. He grew up in the 60s in the Soviet Union. He managed to listen to Hendrix and Dylan and see Easy Rider three times, but there wasn't exactly a big counterculture in Russia. And as Gurevich says, while young Americans rebelled by marching, Russians rebelled by not marching. Growing up in Russia in the 60s is the subject of Gurevich's new memoir, From Lenin to Lenin, you know, from Vladimir to John. Gurevich emigrated to the United States in 1976 at the age of 23. He was already fluent in English when he arrived, having worked as a translator in the Soviet Union. In the States, he's worked as a translator, teacher, and computer programmer. He's also a novelist and playwright. On the day he arrived in the West, there was a Newsweek article about Soviet emigres. When he found the article, he was excited, but by the time he was finished reading it, he was depressed.
I sort of looked at those guys, and they looked very photogenic in their beards, and they looked very intense, and they were, you know, they were dissident emigres. And formally, I was also an emigre, and I was forced into a dissident role at the reception center, where I was told that I better put down political as a reason for immigration. And I tried to fit myself into this stereotype, and that was kind of a sad feeling.
What was the stereotype that you didn't fit?
Well, the stereotype was somebody who is who has been persecuted for his faith, who has been who had been fighting for his, you know, for human rights, who had suffered inhumanly at the hands of the KGB, and on and on and on. And you know, I don't think I mean, against the background of people like Sakharov or Solzhenitsyn, I certainly didn't suffer that much. Maybe I would have suffered if I had left, but I decided to bail out early.
Well, for you, the last straw in the Soviet Union was not being able to get a ticket to a screening of Last Tango in Paris.
Yeah, it's a very sad realization. You know, I mean, when I was reading the... I mean, it did not really come to me... It did not really dawn on me in full until I started writing this book. I was trying to pinpoint down this moment, and that's what came to mind. And again, you know, I feel very uneasy about this, because obviously, you know, some people have, you know, more dramatic moments, you know, being arrested, being told all sorts of things by the KGB, what have you. And but for me, it was the last straw. You know, it's again, you know, I wish I could fit some kind of heroic stereotype, but that's just not it.
What was so impossible to bear about not being able to get a ticket to see Last Tango in Paris?
Well, you know, I just thought that, you know, for most people I know, especially the guy who I went to, you know, to the screening, who tried to get to the screening with, the thought that it was quite normal that this screening should be for some and not for others. You know, it was the fact that we, you know, like normal, ordinary people had to struggle to get to see a movie was normal to most people. And it just dawned on me that it's totally... you know, it's totally idiotic. It's abnormal. Things should not be this way. You know, and it was the realization that this society is totally screwed from top to bottom. and wild at heart. I don't know about that. But I went home thinking that this is total idiocy, this is total abnormalcy, and I should get out.
So you're not someone who was a dissident or an activist, but you are someone who loved movies and loved rock and roll, and you couldn't ever get enough of it. Part of what your book is about is loving things like that and living in the Soviet Union where you didn't have much access to it. How would you get rock and roll records when you were a teenager?
Ooh, that's a science. That's a science. There's so many ways. And it's, you know, incidentally, I mean, with all this variety of of ways of getting those things, once you come down, once I came to the West, my interest started slipping, because all of a sudden it was so wildly available. Actually, the companies wanted you to buy those things, and in my case, the reflection of the 60s spirit is that I immediately resisted this pitch to buy all the rock and roll records. But going back to your question, there was a number of ways. Mostly people who travel abroad, they would be bringing records back, and they would either rent them out to be taped, on tape recorder, or if they're friends, they would just allow you to tape them for free. This was the main, or you would get a couple of records of your own, and you would be swapping it with friends.
What's a record you had in your collection that you were able to trade for a lot of other records? Something that was really valuable for a barter.
That's funny. I didn't have. that was funny because I had a bunch. I had a friend bring me a bunch of Bob Dylan records, and which I listened on and on and on. But then I realized that, and it seemed to me, in my naivete, that everybody should be totally bananas over it, and it didn't turn out to be this way. It did not rate that high. However, I had a David Bowie record, and I had a Jimi Hendrix record, and IU Experienced, as a matter of fact, and I was able to get a lot of mileage out of that.
Today is Bob Dylan's 50th birthday.
Yes, I know.
So what did Dylan mean to you in the Soviet Union? What did you make of his lyrics? You knew English fairly well when you started listening to Dylan, but, his lyrics are so obtuse anyways. I'm wondering what you made of it in the Soviet Union.
Well, it was the mystery, I guess. I mean, I could not get the whole thing, obviously. But I don't think, many Americans can get the whole thing. Like you said, obtuse, And right now, of course, I realize that they were perhaps, a lot of this obtuseness was quite intentional. At that point, it was a little bit like, roving through his lyrics, I felt a little bit like Alice in Wonderland. I did not quite know what, whether to believe him or not to believe him. But the fact was that I received him viscerally rather than cerebrally.
Mm-hmm.
And, whatever it was, first, it was truth, okay? Because this voice could not lie, okay? And secondly, so what if the truth is sometimes obscure? It's truth nonetheless, And if I'm... it's better to get 50% of truth than 100 something that's 100% falsehood, but although it's coming to you abundantly clear.
You had friends who were in rock bands, and they'd sometimes for performance have to submit their lyrics to censors.
Absolutely. You see, the thing is that the in Russia there was always this state. Hypocrisy has always existed on the state scale. That is to say that the kids knew that they were playing just plain rock and roll, okay? And the people who were in charge of those shows, the party ideological, the people in charge of ideology, they also knew it. But nonetheless, everything had to be labeled just so. And this is why, stuff like Stairway to Heaven had to be labeled as an English folk song. Painted Black was, an anthem and a hymn against racism, et cetera, et cetera.
So did they have to change the lyrics?
They didn't, because they were singing in English anyway, and you know, in rock and roll, I mean, you wouldn't be able to recognize those lyrics the way those guys killed the phonetics. So it's very funny the way, you know, English is being transformed.
Were there officially sanctioned rock songs that officially sanctioned people wrote that had really stupid lyrics?
In Russia?
Yeah.
All the lyrics were stupid. You know, the thing is that, like I said, you know, the term itself, the term rock and roll itself was pretty much in the, you know, in the official lingo, in the Russian newspeak, it was associated with something Western and corrupting, you know. So the official term was pop music. And a lot of this was actually, you know, looking back on it, a lot of it was much closer to Euro, what we know as Europop rather than American rock and roll. And all those lyrics were totally hilarious. Like I said, you know, it was something about lovelorn geologists lost in the Siberian taiga and missing their girlfriends and something like this. Because, you see, in the official Russian lore, love can only be a byproduct of being loyal to the state and be doing something useful for the state. Therefore, you know, if there was some kind of love feeling, it was not just she loves you, yeah, yeah, yeah. She loves you because you're doing something good for the state. That was basically the core of any Russian pop song.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David Gurevich, and he's written a new memoir called From Lenin to Lenin. That's from the Soviet thinker to the Beatle, and it's a memoir about growing up in the Soviet Union in the 60s. And Gurevich emigrated to the United States in 1976 at the age of 23, and he's worked as a translator, a computer programmer. He's also a novelist and playwright. We'll take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Soviet emigre David Gurevich is my guest, author of the new memoir, From Lenin to Lenin. The draft was a very big issue for young men in the 1960s in the United States because of the Vietnam War. Apparently the draft was a big issue for you, too. When you were coming of age, the draft age was lowered to 18, but I guess you could still get a college exemption?
Yeah, and that's how I chose college, on the basis of evading the draft, because originally, I wanted to go to journalism school, but you know, after doing some reconnaissance, I figured out that, you know, my chances were very slim, because all of a sudden in the Russian late 60s, journalism has become the most fashionable profession, and so I figured I would go to the language school because I figured that with my English I had a better edge.
So going to college got you out of the draft for good?
No, it was merely a 5-year exemption. Because, you know, the college term in Russia is 5 years, and you get a 5-year exemption. However, in my college, we took military courses, and we were supposed to be military officers, you know, after graduation. We were supposed to be in the reserve. But my case was a clear-cut catch-22, because I was trained, if I was to be an officer, I was to be in the Army Intelligence. And, of course, with 0.5, what they call 0.5 in Russia, meaning Jewish, you know, I could never be trusted to be in Army Intelligence. So they could not draft me as an officer. And by law, they could not draft me as a soldier either, because I already took some officer courses. Ergo, they could not draft me.
Wow, what really convoluted...
Of such convolutions is life in Russia, you know, life in Russia is made.
When you moved to the United States, how well did you relate to other Soviet emigres?
Well,
I should say here that because you were a translator, you spoke English. Maybe you didn't know colloquial English that Americans speak all that well, but you had a grasp of the language. So you weren't forced to rely on other Soviets to help you understand what Americans are saying.
Yeah. Well, you know, you have to... It was a little weird because, you know, frankly, I felt a little bit, ghettoized. And I was trying to break out of this, what I would say, self-imposed ghetto on their part. quite actively. And so most of my friends and most of my social scene in those days was very much American.
During part of your early years in the United States, you translated for Soviet emigres on public assistance.
I still do.
Oh, you still do?
Oh, yeah.
Tell me some of the predicaments that Soviet emigres have been involved with that they really didn't understand, that you've had to help them out
of. Well, it's an interesting phenomenon, because I think, first of all, I'd like to say that, you know, I think that of all groups involved, you know, covered by public assistance, the Soviets are probably one of the few groups for whom it really works. Because it really works as a bridge, the way I think that the social welfare system, you know, was designed in the first place. I have not seen a Russian who has been, very few Russians I have seen have been on welfare for more than a year. I mean, they really use this time, they really go to school and takes all sorts of courses and they get out of it. In the second place, I think that there has been, on their part, the most common feeling is that when they literally expected of America, you know, to the streets to be paved of gold and with gold, and they really expected America to be something so drastically different from Russia. And let's face it, you know, welfare system is not very different from Russia in many ways. It's bureaucracy, it's red tape, it's incredible incompetence, inefficiency. It's the opposite of meritocracy. And they're shocked by it, and, you know, I have, every time, you know, I talk to them, I have to bring them down to earth, so to speak, you know, because I tell them, if you want to, you know, be in America proper, you have to get a job and, you know, go into private sectors, best of all, probably. And another thing that boggles, you know, just totally boggles their imagination is that Russian bureaucracy, they knew how to deal with, okay? They always know that you cannot, you know, meet it headlong, you know, you cannot face it in a dumb way. You have to find ways around it. You have to find loopholes. You have to find somebody who knows somebody else who works in the such and such position. In other words, you don't just walk into a clerk's office. You say, hi, I'd been talking to Ivan Ivanovich, and he told me to talk to you. You know, I mean, it's like a municipal system in New York or Chicago. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's how the entire Russian system works. And anybody who got his job through patronage, you know, in New York or Philadelphia or Chicago knows exactly how the system works.
Have there been difficulties for you having freedom and choices that you weren't used to having in the Soviet Union?
Well, you know, it's still with me. You know, it gets much better, but it's still with me. It's what I call the unbearable burden of freedom. You know, it's very hard once, you know, when you get, you know, when you're used to the system where there's only one of anything and you're lucky if you get, you know, this one item, you know, it's very hard. And I can see it from, you know, on the example of, you know, the Soviets who come to America these days, you know, my relatives and my friends and, you know, other people, you know. And I think another problem is that the problem that I have barely started coming to terms with is that I think that every American has, growing up in a free society, has some notion of how to sell him or herself. And I don't mean like in literal sense, but, you know, he or she would operate in a free market. And whether we're talking about an interview for a job with the university or, you know, selling insurance or what have you. But every American has this skill, however small a scale. Russians have no idea of any of this. You know, like I said before, you know, in Russian system, the way of getting something is going over there, you know, making a few calls and saying, look, I talked to Ivan Ivanovich and he told me that you might have this and that for me. Okay.
So the way to get something in the Soviet Union is to pull strings, not to sell
strings.
Yourself.
No, it has nothing to do with selling yourself. And that's why I think that, I mean, the only people who knew how to sell things in Russia were the black marketeers. And even they were far from, you know, American model. So I think this is going to be a tremendous obstacle in terms of In the Russians' progress towards a more open society, because they have absolutely no idea what market is. I mean, the oil professor market right now in Russia has replaced the place of Marxism on the on the official altar. I mean, you meet like the most hardcore party official. He will say to you, "We believe in market. Of course, it will be our new socialist market, but we believe in market. We're moving towards market." The guy has no idea what market is, but now it's the new dogma.
Right.
You know, Dale Carnegie is the bestseller. I mean, you have seen the book. I mean, Leah Yakaka's book is on every bookshelf.
In the Soviet Union, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's like in every corner.
That's really interesting.
You know, I mean, this is the country where they worship capitalism. You know, like they never worshipped Marxism. The trouble is they still don't know what the hell they're worshipping.
Huh. You know, in your book jacket cover, you're wearing a denim jacket. And that reminded me that, you know, Levi's really had just a special, almost magical image about them when you were in the Soviet Union. So does that still hold any power over you?
Well, it does, in a sense, because this is my, you know, this is my way of dealing with the same freedom that we talked about before. You know, it's very easy for me to buy jeans. You know, I don't go around and shop around. I just go to the store and buy Levi's. That's it. You know, rather than dealing with the...
With all the choices.
With all the choices.
100,000 brands of blue jeans.
That's right. That's right. Unfortunately, I mean, what kills me is that, unfortunately, Levi's has come, you know, with the 20 varieties themselves, you know. So it's you know, I mean, they have all those fly buttons and schmai buttons. And, you know, I don't know how to deal with this. But actually, the choice of the jacket on the cover was not mine. It was the photographer's. You know, I mean, if you ever have been photographed for anything, you know that you have absolutely no say in how you're going to be photographed, what you're going to be wearing, you know, how you want your hair. I mean, the moment you say, okay, take my picture for the book jacket, I mean, you are the bonded slave. That's it.
David Gurevich, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you. It was fun.
David Gurevich is the author of From Lenin to Lenin, a memoir of Russia in the 60s. Well, we would have celebrated Bob Dylan's 50th birthday today with a Fresh Air interview and performance, except that Dylan has never taken us up on our offers to be a guest on our show. But we have comic Richard Belzer doing Bob Dylan.
When I was a teenager, and we started first getting into Bob Dylan, and we found out his real name is Zimmerman, and he's a Jew from Minnesota, and this was like a revelation to have a hero that's a Jew. So I said, if his name is Zimmerman, he must have had a bar mitzvah. So I fantasized what Bob Dylan's bar mitzvah must have been like, you know. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech olam. And then when he gets older, you know, Oi, once upon a time, you dress so fine, you threw the bums a dime in your prime, didn't you? People called Shady Red Doll, you're bound to fall, you thought they was all kidding you.
You dress so fine, threw the bumps of dime in your prime. Didn't you? People call, say, beware, doll, you're bound to fall. You thought they were all kidding you. You used to laugh about everybody that was hanging out. So loud. Now you don't seem so proud about having to be scrounging your next.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we continue the story of Frank Smyth's capture by Iraqi soldiers. After the war, he and several fellow journalists were traveling with the Kurds reporting on their rebellion. When the rebellion was put down by Iraqi soldiers, Smyth was taken prisoner. Photographer Gad Gross was executed. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie that has fire as its star, Backdraft, directed by Ron Howard. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Leading elements of rebel forces in Ethiopia are said to have advanced to within 8 miles of the capital, while Israeli planes airlift thousands of Ethiopian Jews from the country. Meanwhile, one of the main rebel groups has claimed a major victory over government troops. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
The Eritrean People's Liberation Front, the EPLF, says it has captured Asmara, the capital of Eritrea. Ethiopia regards Eritrea as a province. The EPLF has been fighting for 30 years for greater autonomy, if not outright independence, for Eritrea. Taking Asmara would give a tremendous psychological boost to the EPLF. That group now controls virtually all of Eritrea, which provides Ethiopia's only access to the sea. In capturing Asmara, the EPLF also claims to have captured Ethiopia's elite Second Army, which is described as the government's best-equipped force, holding two-thirds of the firepower of the Ethiopian government. The Second Army has been under siege in Asmara for over a year. The State Department has heard reports that Asmara has fallen, according to an official, but has no firm confirmation. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
An earthquake measuring 6.3 on the Richter scale has hit southern Peru and was also felt in parts of Bolivia. A spokesman for the National Earthquake Information Center says the epicenter of the quake was about 80 miles underground. According to police officials in one city in southern Peru, hundreds of people fled into the streets when the quake hit. In New Delhi, the body of former Indian Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi was cremated earlier today. As Julian Crandall-Hollick reports, thousands of people watched the ceremonies for the slain leader.
The body of Rajiv Gandhi was taken on a gun carriage from his birthplace in New Delhi along a six-mile route to the banks of the holy river Jamuna, where it was cremated according to Hindu custom. The city came to a standstill, but although the crowds were large, they seemed subdued, as if still not yet quite comprehending the tragedy that has struck India. The shrouded body, covered with rose petals, was placed on a funeral pyre of sandalwood logs. While priests chanted Hindu prayers, Rajiv's 18-year-old son, Rahul, thrust a flaming torch into the funeral pyre. Family members and close friends added more wood as the flames consumed the mortal remains of the slain leader, closing another chapter in the bloody history of the Nehru-Gandhi family. From New Delhi, this is Julian Crandall-Hollick reporting.
In Colombia, officials say 9 policemen have been killed in ambush a week before scheduled peace talks. According to reports, the officers were killed when a bomb exploded beside a police truck in the northeastern part of the nation. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up almost 14 points to close at 2,913.91 in very light trading. This is NPR News. On Capitol Hill, the Senate has joined the House in giving President Bush the power to work out trade agreements with Mexico and other countries that are amendment-proof. The vote in the Senate was 59-39 to extend so-called fast-track authority for 2 years. Opponents of the plan say that a free trade zone with Mexico will do away with thousands of U.S. jobs because companies will move to Mexico where labor is cheaper. The fast-track idea is that Congress is effectively barred from changing a trade agreement once it is signed, forcing lawmakers to make a take-it-or-leave-it vote on a new treaty. In South Africa, the government has released 8 political prisoners, including some who were on a hunger strike. NPR's John Madison reports from Johannesburg.
In Pretoria, President F.W. de Klerk opened a peace conference today to try and deal with the township violence. The conference included delegates from major political parties, but the African National Congress wasn't there because the ANC believes de Klerk's government is part of the problem, and so it can't sponsor a conference on its own. While the conference got underway, ANC leaders were visiting some political prisoners who are on their 24th day of a hunger strike. Some are in hospital, others in prison cells. The government released 8 of them today, including some of the weakest. But the war of words between the ANC and the government continued over how many political prisoners are still in jail and why, and whether the hunger strikers are receiving adequate care as they enter the period where they're in danger of permanent physical damage. I'm John Madison in Johannesburg.
In London, the Bank of England has eased its key interest rate by 0.5 point. The base lending rate fell to 11.5% from 12%. Government critics charge that the move was too little and too late for thousands of people who have lost their jobs. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. During the Kurdish rebellion following the Gulf War, it was difficult to get information about what was happening, and reporters that managed to get into Iraq were at great risk. Today, the British Ministry of Defense confirmed that 2 bodies were found in northeastern Iraq by Royal Marines who were searching for 3 missing BBC journalists. The bodies are being flown back to England, but have not yet been identified. The first journalist believed to be killed in the war was German photographer Gad Gross, who was on assignment for Newsweek. He was covering the Kurdish rebellion with several other journalists, including my guest Frank Smythe. Smythe was on assignment for The Village Voice, The Economist, and CBS News Radio. Yesterday, Smythe told us that on March 28th, as the Iraqis were smashing the Kurdish rebellion, he, Gross, and French photographer Alan Bou ran into an Iraqi ambush. Gross hid in a nearby house with their Kurdish guide. Smythe believes they were both executed when Iraqi soldiers found them. Smythe and Bou hid in a ditch for 18 hours before they were captured. They were released 17 days later, having spent 2 weeks in an Iraqi prison. Smythe says Saddam Hussein personally made the decision to release him and Bou. Smythe had been charged with being a spy. He says Iraqi soldiers don't comprehend the role of Western journalists.
Iraqi military intelligence has no concept whatsoever of what journalists, particularly Western reporters, do. As my impression, based on what I was able to ascertain inside Iraq in prison, in Iraqi custody, as well as talking to people outside and the response that that we got, indicates that the foreign ministry and the Ministry of Information believed we were reporters and were lobbying for our release. But military intelligence seemed convinced that we were spies, and that me in particular, being an American, that I was a CIA agent. And I believe that they were asking for permission to begin torturing us to find out what it is we knew. Once, of course, they decide to torture you, then even once they, you know, if they find out they're wrong, they have to kill you because they're not going to torture a Western reporter and then let him go. So it's quite clear that they genuinely thought I was a spy, and from their perspective, it's, you know, it certainly made sense. We were found, as it was explained to us, in Iraq, first of all, without a visa. Second of all, we had entered the country with the Kurds, which the Iraqis consider terrorists. And third, we were found not at a checkpoint, but we were found in a combat zone, in a combat situation. There were some reports that rumors running around that there were Western intelligence operatives with the Kurds. I never saw any. I don't know if they were there or not. But certainly I think military intelligence finally thought that, hey, we finally got one. We got this guy, you know, and they really thought that they had finally, you know, had proof of foreign intervention in the Kurdish uprising.
You were eventually taken to an Iraqi prison, and all around you, you heard people being tortured. How did you handle your interrogation? What happened during it?
Well, there were several interrogations. The first one took place in an air base, which was relatively mild. We were not blindfolded. But then there were others where we were blindfolded, and, you know, it went on for maybe an hour and just relentless questions. The worst interrogation occurred April 3rd, I believe, in prison. Someone came to the cell and said, okay, you come with us. I was taken out of the cell. I was blindfolded, led down a corridor and into a room where there were, you know, I couldn't see, but there were obviously many men, you know, maybe at least six men present in the room. They then went through what had now become a very routine interrogation. How did you come into Iraq? Who did you talk to? basically trying to get as much intelligence out of us on the location of Kurdish leaders, Kurdish representatives inside of Syria, the opposition conference in Beirut, etc. But at the end, in the beginning, they said, well, what is your real job? And I said, I'm a reporter, and then went on with the interrogation. Towards the end of the interrogation, which Alan timed, it lasted 2 hours, they said, all right, tell us now about what it is you do. And I said, I'm a reporter. I work for CBS News and The Village Voice and other publications. And they said, no, tell us your real job. Tell us about your relationship with the CIA. And they seemed quite convinced that I was a CIA agent. And they were adamant, and they told me, now, don't lie to us. We know we have our own proof, our own sources. If you continue to lie to us, you will stay here many years. But if you tell the truth, meaning if I confess to being a CIA agent, then you will go free. Alan and I knew that they might make that offer. We knew it was a trap, and we had decided that unless we were, you know, the pain was unbearable and there's something, nothing we could do, we would not under any circumstances make a false confession as to being spies. Barzov, I don't remember his first name, was an Iranian-born British reporter who took that offer. He confessed to being a British intelligence agent on the promise that he would go free, I believe in March 1990, just 1 year before, and he was hanged without trial.
When you were getting interrogated and they were asking you for information on the Kurds and the Kurdish leaders, did you give them that information?
We gave them pretty much things that were already published. One of the problems with military intelligence is they just didn't seem to have access to any publications. If they had read my reports in The Economist or elsewhere or on CBS Radio, it all would have been quite clear who we had talked to and how we had gotten into the country. But that information we did provide. Normally I would never say how I got into an area, but we had no choice but to admit that we had come through Syria because they had our passport, and our passports had an entry stamp for Syria and no exit stamp, so it was clear how we had gotten into Kurdistan.
Were you tortured in any way?
No. Physically, we were never harmed. The guards in the prison made it clear that if and when they got the green light, they were going to have a field day with us. But we were never physically abused.
When you were in the cell and you were hearing a lot of prisoners who were being tortured, you were hearing them scream. You were even able to peek out the window and watch them being tortured. What kind of mental havoc did that play with you mentally? Because I'm sure you were thinking, well, this might be your fate.
You start thinking that, but then in the beginning you start thinking that. When we first got there, we were first in a clandestine house for 3 days and then blindfolded and transferred to prison. And, of course, we were petrified. We thought, oh, no, now we're in prison. We were hoping we'd get out in a few days. Now we're in prison. We knew we were going to be there a while. And I remember Alan saying to me, you know, this is a bad sign. If we start hearing people being tortured, that'll be worse, because why would they put us here and let us hear that if they're planning on letting us go? And, of course, it was only a matter of hours when it began. After a few days, though, we realized that they couldn't touch us, that the guards were under orders not to touch us in any way. And I tried to be positive. I was hoping that Saddam would be pragmatic about it and see it, you know, to be in his interest to try to, you know, for good PR, to release an American and a French reporter. And at that point, I started not, you know, I was able to handle it better personally, and I really was just feeling terrible for the people in the Iraqi prison, Iraqis as well as, I believe, some Sudanese and maybe some Egyptians. Those people, as far as I know, are still there. And certainly, you know, for those people, it was a terrible sense of helplessness. There's nothing one can do in prison. There's no appealing to a lawyer. There's no appealing to the International Committee of the Red Cross. There's nothing. The Iraqi guards and the Iraqi authorities own you, and they can do anything they want to you, physically, mentally, any time they wish. The abuse that we saw of other prisoners was really just horrifying.
Journalist Frank Smyth is my guest. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Frank Smythe. He was held prisoner for more than 2 weeks by Iraqi soldiers. There are a lot of journalists in the United States who were working for your release. And I know at least one of those people was concerned. They were, among other things, going to try to convince the Pentagon to work on your behalf. And I know that at least one journalist was concerned that United States officials might be resistant to working on your behalf because in some of your reporting you'd been critical of the CIA. You had been avoiding the military censorship system during the war. Were you concerned about that?
My main concern in prison was, as a freelance reporter, you're never sure who's going to go to bat for you and who's going to back you up. Since my credentials were CBS, I had a Video 8 camera that I was shooting for the CBS Evening News. I presented myself, the Iraqis may not have heard the Village Voice, as a CBS reporter. Now, the problem that I was afraid of is when Bob Simon, a CBS staff television correspondent, was in prison, there was a tremendous amount of effort done by CBS on his behalf. And my fear was if CBS didn't do something similar for me, then the Iraqis would say, see, they worked hard for Bob Simon, they aren't doing much for Smythe, therefore he must be a spy. Realizing that the Iraqis are probably not going to be able to distinguish quite, would be familiar with the concept of a staff correspondent as opposed to a freelance reporter and a stringer. In fact, CBS did go to bat for me, especially CBS Radio, which I've been with for over three years, and as well as the Committee to Protect Journalists and others.
Now, you think that Saddam Hussein was directly responsible for your release. What makes you say that? What information do you have? And was he pressured to release you? I mean, what did he know? Why did he release you? What can you tell us?
Well, short after we were captured and we were held in this clandestine house, one of our handlers, let's say, a liaison for military intelligence, told us, we now have information. The president is aware of your situation and he is evaluating your case. It was, of course, the next day we went to prison. And then it was 18 days later that guards came to our cell and said, come on, you're going home. It was 11 o'clock at night. There were two gentlemen who presented themselves as being from the Ministry of Information, and they said, you're leaving. As we were driving out of the prison, the guards said, we want you to know that the decision to release Mr. Alan and Mr. Frank came personally from President Saddam. So it's on that basis that we believe he made the decision personally. Also, knowing the way Iraq works, the way the Iraqi military works, a decision of that nature could not, I don't think, possibly be made by anyone else except Saddam Hussein. It's very much a top-heavy system. It's a one-man show, at least at the top.
What do you think his motivation was?
I think his motivation was that he's really reaching out to the West. He's in a very difficult situation economically. His country was destroyed as a result of the Gulf War. He's an extremely pragmatic player. He wants to stay in power, but at the same time, he's extraordinarily weak. And it was clear after we got out that he's really trying to reach out to the press, trying to develop as good a relationship with the press as he could. I also believe, however, had he known that we had witnessed at least heard, if not, though we did not see, but at least had witnessed in an audio sense the execution of Gad Gross, who was a German photographer, I do not think, or at least certainly he would have taken that into account before he let us go. But during our interrogations, military intelligence was much more interested in what we knew about the Kurds and how we had gotten into Iraq, and in trying to prove we were spies, than in really questioning us too thoroughly on what had happened to Gad Gross.
Have the Iraqis admitted to the murder of Gad Gross? Has his body been released?
To the best of my knowledge, the Iraqis have never said anything about Gad Gross. In fact, their actions and words seem to indicate that their position is that he never existed. This, of course, is not true, and the Iraqis know that because they had his camera bag and his passport in their possession. It moved with us between all the military intelligence handlers, all the interrogators, up until we were transferred to prison. It was in the car with us when we were taken to prison. That's the last we saw of it. So certainly they know he exists. He existed. They know he was there. They have his camera bag. They have his passport. The family has now made an appeal to have the body retrieved. And to the best of my knowledge, the Iraqis have neither confirmed nor denied having any knowledge of the case.
As one of the last people to see the journalist Ghad Grossen, as one of the two people who heard his murder, I wonder what responsibility you feel to his family now. Have you visited with them or called them or anything?
Yes. The whole time I was probably the most difficult thing of this whole ordeal was that fact. The whole time I was in prison, I was thinking about how I would approach the family and his photo agent, who was also a friend of his. There were several memorial services which I attended, and there will be another one, I believe, June 4th at Photographers Association in New York. But I've actually become very close to the family since we were released.
Frank Smyth, one last question. Would you ever cover an insurgency again?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, the problem is my family. I mean, it's very difficult having been missing. They went through a terrible ordeal. But at the same time, you know, I think we did what we did for the right reasons. We were there to ascertain the situation and to try to get the truth and to try not only to document what was happening in Iraq, but to try to document and portray why the Kurds were rebelling and what was the nature of the Kurdish struggle. And you can't do that from a hotel room. You have to do that from the field. And I think that's just the nature of the business.
Frank Smyth, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Frank Smyth recently wrote about his capture and release in The Village Voice. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, what do you have on the airlift of Ethiopian Jews to Israel?
15,000 people are being moved, Terry, from Addis Ababa, which is itself a city almost under siege, to Tel Aviv in the space of about 36 hours. And we have a very vivid eyewitness account, a woman who is in the Israeli compound and who's seen it all. We also will have a report on Rajiv Gandhi's funeral, an explanation of the Hindu rituals of that funeral, and a very interesting story on arms sales to Iraq, and another eyewitness report from inside Baghdad.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The heat is always on in Hollywood to come up with films that capture the current national mood. Film critic Stephen Schiff says that despite the clichés, the new movie Backdraft may do just that.
You probably hadn't noticed Hollywood's shocking neglect of the firefighting industry, had you? Before Steven Spielberg's movie Always, which was marginally about forest fires, you'd have to go all the way back to 1974 and The Towering Inferno. And that movie was less about firemen than about the pleasure of watching the world's most obnoxious celebrities go up in smoke. There's a reason for Hollywood's reluctance, of course. Except on the evening news, firefighting doesn't easily lend itself to drama. Boy meets fire, boy puts out fire, what kind of movie is that? These questions must have weighed heavily on the minds of director Ron Howard and screenwriter Gregory Wyden, and the result of their endeavors is obvious. Backdraft slaps together every successful movie cliché you can think of, only with fire. Kurt Russell and William Baldwin, Alec's baby brother, play the McCaffrey boys, firefighting sons of a heroic fireman killed in the line of duty. Russell, talking like John Wayne and swaggering like him too, is the older one, the ace lieutenant who knows how to think like a fire, how to follow it through a building and head it off at the pass. Baldwin is the scared rookie assigned to his big brother's firehouse. So what have you got? The rival brothers formula, only with fire. The rookie and the grizzled old-timer formula, only with fire. Russell's wife, played by Rebecca De Mornay, leaves him because he's too dedicated to firefighting, and she never can be sure he'll come home safely. That's the oldest cop movie cliché in the book, only with fire. And yet, there's something to be said for all that fire. Robert De Niro, playing an arson investigator, says it best.
It's a living thing, Brian. It breathes, it eats. It hates. The only way to beat it is to think like it. To know that this flame will spread this way across the door and up across the ceiling, not because of the physics of flammable liquids, but because it wants to. Some guys on this job, fire owns them. Makes them fight it on its level. The only way to truly kill it is to love it a little.
Under Ron Howard's direction, the fire does breathe and eat and hate. At times you can see it looking at its victims, planning its next move, pulling a fast one, or retiring to plot an ambush. During the big conflagration scenes, Backdraft becomes a kind of monster movie, and the fire's various powers are as fascinating and unexpected as those of the shark in Jaws or Sigourney Weaver's Alien. The film's cast of characters divides neatly between those who are haunted by the wonder and terror of fire and those who aren't. And the haunted ones give the best performances, among them Russell and De Niro, and also Donald Sutherland. He's lusciously hammy as the Hannibal Lecter of firebugs, rotting in jail while arson investigators come to him for advice, another borrowed formula. These clichés, in fact, would make you laugh. There's even a burst of Star Wars stuff toward the end, except that the film really moves, and there's something stirring about it. Backdraft is about brave men fighting to protect plain folks like you and me. It's a hymn to heroic testosterone. And even though the tub-thumping macho gets a little repugnant, I'll bet it proves a good match for the post-Gulf War mood. Just in time for the yellow ribbons and welcome home parades, Backdraft plays like an all-American victory celebration. Only with fire.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you have a great holiday weekend. And congratulations to our intern Tracy Hildebrandt. She just graduated from Temple University.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we catch up with one of early rock and roll's powerful voices. Laverne Baker's hits included Jim Dandy and Bumblebee. Also, a talk with David Alan Greer from In Living Color. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.